Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Eric Shapiro. David North Martino. John Copenhaver. And Al Warren. On KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles.
102.3 FM Riverside.
And 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the house of mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Michael Hawley. It's going to be a scary day. It's always scary when Hawley's in the room.
That's absolutely right, Al. And I do that on purpose, just to, you know, sell more books, you know,
yeah.
Jack the Ripper, all that kind of business.
All that murder stuff. Listen, so did you lose your Facebook yesterday like everybody else?
No, but I did like last year, and it just crushed everything. So maybe I've been doing the right thing now, as in, I don't know. I didn't do anything bad last time. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's not usual. You have to get back to drinking some good beer and doing some bad stuff.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Now, we are talking with an author again today, and the book we're focusing on, of course, we're going to talk about all of her books because she's quite the writer, but the book is The Case of the Bereaved Butler, a cozy Welsh murder mystery full of twists. The Wise Inquiries Agency Mystery, and it's book 9. So, Kathy Ace, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Nice speaking with you.
Nice to meet you, too.
It's a pleasure. So, listen, first of all, I see this as like book 9 of a mystery series. Before we get into the more of the details of the series and stuff like that, I always want to ask someone like yourself who does several books in a series like this, at the very beginning of all this, where it all started, book 1 of this series, did you have it in your mind to write several books? I always wonder, do you kind of have this, you know, is it the character and the story and all this stuff, and you've got like 20 cases for this character, so you've got lots of books coming? Or does this just happen as it goes?
Well, I'm one of those people who are definitely life planners. Not everything goes according to plan, of course. But yes, when I created these characters, I really did want them to have lots of adventures. This, of my 2 series, is much more the character-driven series. And the thing with the character-driven series is you need those characters to live a considerable bit of life for the whole of their life story to be able to become apparent to the reader. I mean, if you're writing a standalone, obviously the stakes are higher for the main characters because they might not make it to the end of the book. When you've got a series, the challenge is the readers know that any danger cannot precipitate the death of a main character, generally speaking. But it does mean, hopefully, they want to know what happens next in the lives of those characters. So yes, I really did want to tell a lot of stories about these characters because there are 4 main characters with at least 3 frequently available to the reader secondary characters. And it's really difficult to tell a whole lot about a whole lot of people in one book. So it's an ongoing situation in my head and hopefully in the desires of the readers to keep going.
Right. And of course, the character is always the main part. It doesn't matter how good the mystery is or how wild it is. People stay with character, don't they, more than anything?
As a reader, I do tend to, yes. And most readers I speak to would agree with that, yes. You've got to want to spend time with those main characters. They can be flawed, they can be irritating, they can be delightful. I think what I try to do is write relatable characters so that readers can at least relate to them and care what happens next.
So with these characters, you've got a Welsh, Irish, Scottish, and English lady. They're all in a stately home is the business. And so are they, it's kind of like a group that love each other and kind of argue with each other. How's that work?
Well, yes. They can rub each other up the wrong way sometimes. Yeah, you're right. One is Welsh, Irish, Scottish, English. They're all women from very different backgrounds. The Welsh woman was raised on a sheep farm, and she's in her 30s and quite mumsy. She's got a baby now. And the Irish one is the very headstrong daughter of an impoverished Irish viscount. The Scots woman is a retired army nurse and frankly takes no, she really will not be putting up with fools gladly or otherwise. And the English woman is the daughter of Windrush generation parents from St. Lucia, who was raised in the East End of London. And they've all met several books, novellas ago, and have decided that they can work as a team to run a professional private investigations agency. They've all done their training, and they've each got strengths, and they've each got slight blind spots. So they work together now. They rent a converted barn on the estate of the Chellingworth estate. The Duke and Duchess of Chellingworth live there, as does the Dowager, Althea. And Althea's lovely. She's in her 80s, huge fan of Monty Python, and she likes to help. And you can't see it, but I'm doing those rabbit ear things as I say help, because quite often she's not at all helpful. And they are very cosy mysteries. They're delightful Welsh village romps. It's not Downton Abbey because it's contemporary, but you do get the aspect of the upper crust versus the villagers. And sometimes it literally is versus, you know, if there's a croquet match involved, they are against each other. But they all live in the same world and have to get on as a team. And they do. And I like that. I enjoy creating situations where good comes out of the bad and order is restored.
It's an interesting thing. How do you get into the headset of your character? How do you get into the mind? Because you're saying you've got four main characters, so you're writing with four different personalities or points of view, you might say. And how do you get into the head, and how do you know who's going to do what and how they're going to react and stuff? How do you keep that all, you know, level playing so you can understand it, remember it?
I mean, I suppose the honest answer is because they're all real to me. In my head, they are real people, and I can see them and I can hear them. And I am a planner, a plotter when it comes to laying out a book. And with four people going off investigating at least three cases in each book, I have to do very detailed plotting for these books so that I make sure I don't have one person in two places at the same time. And I make sure that another person is there to help a colleague when they need supporting. And my deep, dark, dirty secret is all of these people are based upon real people that I know in my life. They might be a mashup of two people or even three, but they are all known to me in real life. And I can think, oh, yes, so-and-so wouldn't say that or wouldn't do that. Now, after nine books, the characters have kind of taken over from what were those real life people in the first place. So, yeah, I make sure that I'm with my friends and they are speaking with their voices as they tell their stories, which is not to say I let them do anything they like, because, as I say, I'm a planner, and I'll add to that a bit of a control freak. So plotting, planning, making sure that things happen when I need them, where I need them, with the person for whom that would be the most suitable or the most challenging situation.
Right. So you're still in charge, but but you're not doing anything. You know, you don't drive when they're talking to you, do you?
I tend not to, although I must admit, I do find driving a great way for an idea to pop into my head. Like mowing the grass, weeding. I do a lot of my plotting because all of my plotting's in my head. I plot in my head and I don't write anything down until I've seen the movie in my head from the beginning to the end. Then when I've seen the movie, that's when I break it down into an outline, an overall outline. Then I break it down into chapter outlines. Then when I sit down to actually physically write the book, my job is to get the movie that was originally in my head onto the page without any of the words getting in the way of the storytelling.
So it sounds like you do that without drinking wine or something, because that would really confuse you if you had a few too many wines.
Yeah, no, it tends to be black coffee and Diet Coke.
There you go. Get you up and going, but doesn't impair you.
That's right.
So you come up, these are kind of based on people you know or personalities from people you know.
Originally, yes.
Originally, like there was some seed in something you saw in someone, some behavior, and you kind of absorbed that, and that's turned into a character. I wonder, so you're evil people in the book, so the bad person, the ones that cause the trouble and do the bad things or did the murder or whatever the case. Are they from the same sort of, from people as well that you've seen, maybe in a coffee shop, or maybe you know them, or you've worked with people, and they kind of inspired the bad person, you might say?
Inspiration as opposed to actuality, yes. I mean, put it this way, while I deal with murder mysteries in these books, many of the murders that I deal with have arisen from circumstances with which many of us might be able to relate, we can relate to in our normal lives. These are people who've taken that step which most human beings would not take. So of course there's something that sets them apart from the rest of humanity in that way. However, every real life murderer lives a life amongst other people and generally speaking will go unrecognized for the fact that they are about to become a killer. Or, in many instances, for many years after they've done the deed, still remain unrecognized as having been a killer. And it's that sort of hidden nature of the ability to take that final dreadful step that is something that I try to investigate. The people that tend to end up being the baddies in my books are normal people finding themselves in abnormal circumstances who have chosen to take a, thank goodness, highly unusual step to solve what they see as a problem. And ultimately, they believe that they and their needs are much more important than anyone else's needs in the world, and believe the only way they can achieve their goals is by getting someone out of the way.
Right. That kind of sounds like Michael in a way, you know.
Yeah, you know, I have a little more lack of remorse serial killing in me, so it doesn't sound like that, though.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of an interesting concept, but in a way, now, you still have to explain kind of why they're doing the bad thing. Like, the reader's got to understand that, right? Like, they've got to pick up that, you know, why would someone want to do this? And they, because that bad person usually thinks they're doing the right thing in a way, or thinks they're okay, that they need to do this? Is that, that's kind of how I see it?
But what is that? I mean, let's look at, you know, the way that step can be taken. There might be something where a death occurs as the result of a violent outburst, which wasn't meant, but had dreadful implications. And then it's the cover-up that becomes the source of the mystery, which leads back to, oh, okay, there was that instigating occurrence and that was the outcome. Or it can be, as you say, they think they're doing the right thing. Not many of my killers believe they're doing the right thing for anyone other than themselves. Without giving away killers and therefore giving spoilers, it's difficult to be specific. But I have had in various of my books people who have killed not because they wanted a good outcome for themselves directly, but because the person being out of the way allows another person to benefit and that matters a great deal to them. So it's a sort of a secondary beneficiary, if you see what I mean. Or it might be that they have, in fact, found another person to be worthless in their view and have decided that the world would be better off without them because they are a bad person. So they, psychologically speaking, a killer might be able to justify killing someone to themselves, and we would look at that and say there is never a good reason to take that step. Alternatively, they might find themselves facing a set of circumstances where a bad result has come from a situation over which they might have initiated it, but they ultimately had no control over the outcome, and then they set about undertaking various actions which cover that up because they don't want to receive the blame for the accidental thing having happened in the first place. Some stories are terribly tragic that I tell. Other stories are uplifting, might be the wrong word, because somebody somewhere has lost someone important to them. But I do think that they are always explained in a way that the reader will understand, even if they don't necessarily sympathize with the killer. I do generally, in these books, aim to allow the reader to continue their sympathy residing with the victim.
Do you have kind of a subtext? You kind of have a meaning with each of these books in the series, for instance. So someone picks it up and reads it. Is there something underlying that you hope that they take away, or is it pure entertainment, puzzle, mystery type thing?
There's always a subtext for me. With this particular series, each book will have a theme. The one that's coming out this month, the case of the bereaved butler, the butler's brother has died. And within this book, there are several different cases. The case of the exceptional evacuee, for example, being a case of another. The case of the disappearing decorating supplies is another. So there's usually quite a whimsical case in there alongside the rather darker ones. But this book tends to show an interplay between lots of different types of brotherly relationships. That's been the underpinning behind this particular book. Whereas the next book is going to look at the way that property affects community, and community changes when property is dealt with in a different way. The rising up of things like Airbnbs, hollowing out seaside communities in Wales, for example. It's that sort of concept that underlies that book. And each book will have a different concept, but I try not to use a giant mallet when it comes to concepts and themes. But I do like there to be an interplay between the cases so that the reader gets an additional sense of satisfaction when they come to the end of the book, I hope.
How do you recover from a book? Like when you take the time and write and go through the whole experience and live through your characters and all of the different things that happen and it's finished, you get it published. How does that change you, do you think? Or how do you think you're affected by it?
Well, I start by drinking like a fish, you know, away with the coffee and the Diet Coke at that cake. No, bottle of bubbles comes out. That's great. However, I think all authors understand that the writing, the end, then the editing, then the publishing, they're all just steps along a journey. And I'm not entirely sure that any journey ever finishes. Because what I find, this book coming out this month, I think will be my 23rd or 24th novel. And I find all of those stories are now layered upon me, like the strata in sedimentary rock. And I am always burrowing my way out of or back down into each of those strata each time I plan a new book. Because I write two series, I do find that most of my readers have read the whole series. So they've gone on the journey with those characters. You've got to do the thing of allowing a new reader jumping in at book seven to generally gather what's going on and who everybody is and why they're doing what they're doing. But I grow as my characters grow, I believe, and I'm enjoying the life journeys that they are all taking. That's how it changes me. And my life affects the characters as well. I've got a wide range of people of different ages and different backgrounds in my close circle of friends. And that knowledge does tend to come out in the books. I mean, I'm typical sandwich generation, you know, I have an elderly mum, thankfully still with us, and six grandkids. So you're being pulled in two directions all the time. And there you are as a family unit in the middle, having to make everything work by juggling soot, basically. And I'm not unusual in that. And I'm really not unusual in terms of my readers having a similar life experience. So all of that tends to get swooshed in there, in with all those layers of sedimentary rock.
Right. And your four protagonists.
And they all have their own sedimentary layers as well, yes.
Now, I have a question is, what does WISE stand for?
Welsh, Irish, Scottish, English.
W-I-S-E. Oh, and that's what it is.
Yeah. It used to be the four home nations of the International Rugby Union tournament, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, England. We've now got France and Italy as well, so it's Six Nations Cup, not Four Nations Cup. And it's something that you grow up with in the UK. WISE is Wales, Ireland, Scotland, England.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Now you know.
I'm wise. You're I'm wise. Wise.
And they are, of course, the wise women, because they use their wisdom and their professional knowledge and all of their professional skills as well as their life knowledge.
I noticed just in the reread of the newest book coming out here and stuff, how you bring in World War II. When you bring in historical parts, I guess you have to really research out that to make it fit and make it understandable to someone reading now in today's day.
Yes, I don't write historical, as you quite rightly pinpoint. I write contemporary. But the World War II, the evacuation of children from London to Wales at the beginning of World War II is something that impacted the London population and the Welsh population significantly. My mum was a child during the war years in Wales, and she knew of people who had evacuees staying with them. And there always tends to be in these books at least one story where there's a nod back to a particular part of Welsh history. And that might be relatively recent with World War II, or it might be harking back to medieval times, for example, because I do like to weave that Welsh history through the book somewhat. This particular case of the evacuees coming to Wales, it took a little brushing up on my research in terms of what I was doing, but it happens to have, writing the book was coinciding with the anniversary of the Blitz of Swansea, where I'm from in Wales. And it's one of those things that's indelibly marked into all of our souls. You know, it's like that many years ago, someone was in fact trying to kill my mother. So we do tend to take it quite personally, you know? So to have the evacuees leaving the East End of London, where there were basically targets on the Woolwich Arsenal for the Nazi bombers to hit, is something that still resonates within my age group and older, and I believe younger, across the UK, especially where in parts where we were heavily bombed.
Right. Well, I think that's really an important part. I think to incorporate some of the things that were part of your life. And because a lot of young people today, especially, you know, let's say in Canada and the US, I think they're out of touch with a lot of that. They wouldn't be aware of the details of something like that, evacuation of children and the Blitz and stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Because yeah.
It's that much further away. If you're born in, you know, 1990, you don't have a clue when you're in 2020 what was going on 100 years ago.
Yes, you know you weren't playing on bomb sites growing up like I was.
Right, that's all missing.
Yeah, and they moved 1.5 million children in 3 days, you know. 1.5 million children. It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think that those are key moments that need to be put into books, even in a fictional or a cozy, a mystery and stuff like, because it incorporates something that's real to someone in our lives that we weren't aware of maybe. you know?
Yes.
I think that adds a touch or an element to a story that makes the story more believable. Do you know what I mean? You know, it kind of makes it more of a real story, even though it's a fiction, you know?
I do. I think it's important that we've got those sort of touchstones of reality within our works of fiction. And different authors choose to do that in different ways, I know. And depending on which book I'm writing, I will use different type of touchstones. In this instance, because we're coming to the time now where those evacuees, and this storyline is about an evacuee who's trying to find the people on the farm to which he was evacuated. These people are all now going to be hitting their 90s, or in their late 80s at least. And that's the age group that my mum is in, as I say. And quite often things that she says to me or stories from her life will inspire me. But equally, I like to delve, as I say, into hundreds of years ago in terms of Welsh history or Welsh mythology and Welsh traditions for particular times of the year. One of these books, for example, ends up with a big celebration of Halloween, but it's not the American or North American version of Halloween. It would be the traditional Welsh version of Halloween. And I like to bring those sorts of traditions to people's attention as well.
Right. I think that's great. I think it makes for a richer book, right? It makes for a fuller book for me anyway. That's how I see it.
I hope so. Yeah.
And I think it's good. I think it's good to carry that on. What is kind of your how do you say your standard, your way of writing, in the sense of, do you have a process? Do you like sit down 9 to 5 Monday to Friday and go, I'm going to write? Can you just turn it on, or do you have to be in a certain mood and run in and just sort of write it that way?
Well, 20 years working in marketing and advertising taught me you can't wait for the muse to arrive. If you've got a client with a deadline, you have to sit down and meet your deadline. So what I do, my process is, as I've mentioned, I don't write anything down until I've got to the end of the story. Then I'll do my outlining and all of my research. So that's a period of time that could be, that's a fairly elastic period of time, let's put it that way. When I sit to then write the book, I will then type, and I can't type properly. I was never taught to type properly. I have to do Latin instead of typing, which has proved useful, but not quite as useful as typing lessons would have done. So I then hammer away at the keyboard. I tend to, I'll be in the office in the morning doing like office work, promotion, publicity, emails, speaking to people on the phone. Then the afternoon session will be writing. Then I'll break and do things with my brain, like watching science fiction or murder mysteries on television. Then I do a night shift from about 10 till about 2, because I'm a good nighttime writer. So I will be hammering at the keyboard for about 8 to 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, until that book is finished. After that, I might not write a book for a month or so, but I will be working at it every day, constantly, really hard, wearing out my fingers, my back and my brain until it's done. And then it's done. That's the first draft. And then you start the job of rewriting and polishing and so on. So,
do you have any beta readers help you out, or?
At that stage, well, I use my editor will do my structural edit. I'll do the first draft and one pass through it for ridiculous mistakes that I've made. It'll then go to her and she'll do a structural edit at that early stage so that she and I have an opportunity to catch any real flaws in what I have hoped will be seamless plotting. Once that's happened, then I'll start the rewrites. It will then be read by 2 or 3 handpicked people when it's at 3, going back to my editor stage. Then she'll work on it. Then it'll come back to me. Then it goes for proofing. Then it comes back to me. Then it goes back for proofing again. So it's a fairly convoluted process. And that can and does happen sometimes when I'm already working on the next novel. Depending on how my life and my year pans out, this year I've had to be doing that on one book while I'm working on another. And then there'll be a third book later in the year.
So how I do it, I'm doing the hammering, then I get hammered. See how that works?
Yes, I do. Very good. Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, can't win. Well, so you tend to write, but in a, you would call it more of a cozy, traditional detective. You don't get into graphics. There's not a lot of violence or any of that in the books in general, right?
This particular series is true cozy. It's not the North American style of cozy. It's the British style of cozy. So I think many North Americans might call that traditional, as opposed to cozy. So there are no cats solving mysteries in cheese shops, because that's a very North American style of a cozy. These are British village mysteries, much more your Miss Marple in that respect. But there's no graphic violence on the page. There's no strong language. There's no sex on the page, although people do have children, so somebody somewhere is getting up to some.
Yeah, something happens.
Just somewhere. Not on the page.
There.
Yeah. Well, do you ever think about the reader in the sense of are they standing over your shoulder? Are they kind of while you're writing, when you're sitting down writing, not so much getting the idea, but when you're actually writing it out, do you think about what the reader is going to think as you're writing?
Yes, and one particular reader in mind is my mum. My mum's always been one of my first readers. As she's coming up to 90, her ability to keep up is not as great as it once was. So she's now one of my first readers once the book is out. But I write what I do because I've grown up reading what I did. And much of that came from my mother's bookshelf. So it's the classic of Agatha Christie, Neil Marsh, Marjorie Allingham, Dorothy L. Sayers, those sorts of books are what I grew up reading, as well as Ellery Queen. And my dad had the, had all the Bond books and would have Alastair MacLean. So I read those as well. And whilst I do still have most of those books here, my reading is actually quite dark, whereas my writing is quite light.
So you actually go out and kill the people and then write lightly about it.
Yes.
Take it out on people.
I do like some particularly dark writers, and I do find myself laughing at totally inappropriate situations. But you know, that isn't me. That's not my milieu. It's not what I find I'm drawn to writing. Although that said, you know, in this particular book, there is one particular character, Alexander Bright. He's a bad boy. Used to be a transporter in Brixton, South London, about 30, 40 years ago. Dragged himself up by this bootstraps from the Sink Estates. He's not black enough for the black gangs to accept him, and certainly not white enough for the white gangs to accept him. So he's always been a loner. Struggled his way out of there, and he's now reached the point where most of his businesses are successful and he knows relatively few people with criminal records, and he's now being dragged back into his old life to help a friend. And my readers will know that Alexander Bright is the fiance of Christine Wilson Smythe, the daughter of the Irish Viscount. She loves the bad boy thing. But has she tamed him too much, she worries. If only she knew, think my readers. And I love the fact that sometimes my readers know the characters better than the other characters know each other. So sometimes there's a darkness in there. And yeah, you know, South London criminal gangs get a look in. I don't like to ignore the fact they exist. And having lived in Brixton for nearly 20 years myself, I know quite well. So I will draw in the dark, because only sometimes when we have a little glimpse of a shadow do we realize that we prefer the sunlight.
Have you used your readers, or has any readers kind of enlightened you into anything, or allowed you to go to a different path just because of what the readers were asking?
Not particularly, in all honesty. There was one lovely lady I met who has now become a named character in this series. And she came up with a wonderful backstory for her character, which I politely declined. I hope it was polite. I wanted that character to go in a particular direction. And it's funny, I've just sent her an email a couple of days ago, actually, because the character that is named for her has had a mother for a few books, but the next book she's going to be named. And I just wanted to run past the name I was proposing for the character that's named for her mother in case it was hurtful or had bad personal reactions for her. She was fine with it, but would have preferred a different name, her mother's name, which I've politely declined. So sometimes people can get involved in a little way, but again, you know, control freak.
You know, when you talked about what you were reading and stuff, you know, which helped shape you in a way, when you bring up Agatha Christie, how do you feel about things like the publishers now changing some of the text and wording and stuff to, let's say, fit today's generations? I guess that's the best way to say it. It's just kind of making it a little bit more sensitive, let's say, to readers and stuff. Do you kind of like that when they do that, or would you rather them stay away from that?
I didn't know they were doing that with Agatha Christie books. It's something I know that they did with the Nancy Drew books back in the 1960s. They withdrew them all and republished them.
Well, they've done it with her before, like the 10 little, you know, like some of the titles and some of her original stuff. And they did that with, and then there were one, right?
And then there were none.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
In that particular instance, I think there was a very good reason for doing that and that they've done the right thing. You can't walk away from the cover and title of a book as easily as you can choose to not open a book or turn off a television or put the book down and say it's not for you. Other than that, I think the route of notes at the front of a text that warn the reader that at the time the book was written, different circumstances and norms might have existed, and that the reader needs to be warned about that before they read the book in question is critical. And that might be the most helpful way to tackle this particular topic. Issues can be triggering. They can be incredibly upsetting and hurtful for people enjoying a read and then finding them slapped in the face with something that really viscerally upsets them. And I understand that that can happen. So a warning, I would say, would be the best way to go about it. There are so many works of literature going back down through the centuries, which were created in completely different times by a tiny percentage of the population of even the day at that time, which reflected society that they knew, which might not have been the societal experience of the 99% of the rest of the population at the time. So I suspect that whilst literature's always been challenging, and I think it's a great thing that it does challenge, that giving people a heads up as to the challenges they might personally face in that book today is a better way to do it, rather than banning or changing.
Yeah, I sort of agree with that in a sense, because I'm a little worried about when they do the upgrade, as they say, or the changes of it, losing the original text, do you know? Because I think that the way she wrote was a product of who she was and where she lived and what was around her and how she lived and what was going on at that time. And I don't think we should change that. I think the warning is probably better, because as they change, then the original text gets lost.
I mean, it's a process of a step at a time, isn't it? And not knowing the specifics of it. I mean, if I look back at things I've written 12, 13, you know, 15 years ago, I might choose now to couch things in different ways. And I would like the opportunity to do that. She's dead and doesn't have the right to say that. However, she does have living relatives who are very much representing her estate and her legacy. So ultimately, they are the curators of her legacy. And if they believe that that legacy is endangered because of the use of words which had a different received meaning when they were written than they would be perceived to have these days, I think they've got the right to do that.
Certainly, certainly interesting times we live in.
Well, times are always interesting. It all depends on where you're standing and looking at them, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess your point of view of how long you've lived and kind of what you've been through kind of certainly gives a different sort of perspective than a really young person now. So, yeah, I don't know. I always question things like that, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the answers are. I guess I'll never be old or wise enough.
Well, wise enough's the question. I'm not sure. Yeah, sometimes I'm not sure age has got a lot to do with it. Sometimes the older we get and the more we've lived, the more reactionary we can become and the more we become stuck in our ways. So maybe looking forward is the way to go with these things rather than looking back, because there have been an awful lot of people who have been hurt tremendously by the 1% who get published having their worldview produced as the worldview. And maybe we don't really understand that we're so privileged to be published authors that sometimes we don't realize that we are speaking of our privilege when most voices, many voices, have never even had a chance to be heard.
Exactly. I think that's a lot of it too, right? Wow. So how long does it take you to go to put one of these books out? How long is it taking you to write an actual book in the mystery series from beginning to end?
Well, that's the thing. Like I say, the whole planning bit is really quite elastic. So for me, the writing process is a whole process from the beginning idea through until the book is published. Could be anything from, you know, I'm thinking about the one that I will be writing in July already, and I've been thinking about it for a couple of months. I'll then get into the heated part of the plotting and the writing, the physical typing of the first draft will probably take me 2 to 3 weeks of working 7 days a week. That's really due to the speed of my typing as opposed to anything else, because all the plotting, all the research, all of that's been done before, and then I'm working from my chapter by chapter outlines, so I know exactly who is where. I've done all of the name invention, all of the backstories for all the characters. I know my poisons or my weapons or my locations, whatever it is, all of that's done, and then I'm just writing that movie, typing as fast as I can. And when I type the end, I know that's actually the beginning, because then the first thing you have to do is go back and put it all right. So the whole process, I can at most write 3 books a year. That I know for me is my absolute limit. So if you were to say on average, that would be a 4-month project per book, I guess that would be a fair average to say.
Well, you know, You got to take into account the times when you go out and poison people to see how it works.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Right. Yes. And dig the hole.
Your research.
And dig the hole for the body afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. All that stuff's got to be realistic. So you got to get out and do it. You know. And well, what do you find your favorite thing is in the writing process and the whole, you know, beginning to end and everything you've been through and stuff? What do you cherish the most about writing?
Oh, gosh, each part has pros and cons. I love plotting and planning because that means I'm also living my life. So I'm off somewhere lovely and sunny, sitting on a cruise ship, or I'm weeding in the garden, or I'm visiting Wales, or whatever I'm doing. Usually I'm plotting while I'm doing other things. So that is a particular delight. I enjoy then writing that down and breaking that up, because I do have a process-driven mind. I've got a very linear thought process, so I like getting things into lists and portions and headings and subheadings. I find that incredibly satisfying. Then the physical writing of the first draft is, I look at it this way, right? You know, 3-day eventing with horses. For me, Writing a first draft is like the steeplechase. You're just a horse being a horse. You're just a writer being a writer. You're a storyteller telling your story for the first time from beginning to end. And I love it. Then you have to do the editing bits. And that's like the show jumping, where there are rules that you have to follow and you have to make sure that the turns are nicely done. And then you come to the blessed final polishing and copy editing, which is like the dressage, which I find completely unnatural, but it's critically important to allowing the reader to have the best experience they can have of the book. So all of those elements are all horse. All of those elements are all writer, but they're different aspects of being that person. And then you come to the setup and the publishing and the promotion and the publicity and the cover design. I love it all, but for very different reasons.
Well, what was it that gave you the, let's say, the push? Was there a certain thing that happened in your life that gave you that extra zing to actually decide to publish, to actually let other people read what you write?
There was. It all started in an airport. My sister was late coming back from a vacation. I was there to pick her up. And I picked up a magazine, which I never do. I never spend money on magazines. And there was a competition in there called Murder and Be Published. Now, this is back in the 80s. So what happened was I wrote a short story. It won. It was published. Woohoo! And the brief for the short story was it just had to have a main character that was a female. Very blurry. So I used that. Anyway, that short story ended up then going on to the British GCSE English language syllabus for all 16-year-olds in another anthology. And it then ended up going on to BBC Radio 4 as an afternoon reading. And all of that was wonderful. And my parents in Wales almost exploded with pride. And I, at that point, was very happy with things. I'd written about 9 textbooks on marketing before that. But unfortunately, my dad died, and I realized that apparently there's this thing called mortality. So if I was ever going to write fiction, I should actually do something about it. So I wrote another 11 short stories to go with the first one I'd written and self-published those. Then I thought, oh, I quite like that. I'll try a longer form. I wrote 4 novellas, self-published those. And then I did exactly what everybody tells you not to do. I had a copy of each of those volumes and I wrapped them in a ribbon and I made a ransom note, cutting letters out of a newspaper. And I sent the parcel to a publisher in Canada, begging them to release the characters. And that was when they invited me to submit a manuscript for a novel to them, featuring the only Canadian character, the Welsh Canadian character, Kate Morgan. They were a Canadian publisher. They picked up on the fact that she was a Welsh woman living in Canada. And that was my first published novel, which came out in 2012. That was The Corpse with the Silver Tongue, the first Kate Morgan mystery. So I was kind of trying to prove things to myself and have something for my mum to read. My mum would go into bookshops and see my marketing textbooks on the shelf and was underwhelmed. She was thrilled when there was a murder mystery, you know?
Interesting process that we all go through to get there, you know?
And I think the traditional publishing worked well for me, largely because I really didn't know anything else at the time. But wanting people to read my stories, listen to me. You can't shut me up, can you? I'm a gabber. I'm a storyteller and always have been. And for me, writing novels is a great way to tell stories.
Well, listen, are you in the social media world? Do you have like Facebook and all that? Do you have a website? How do you like people to interact with you and readers and stuff? And if so, how do you like to do that?
You know, my website is my sort of hub. Readers can find out about all of my works there, a little bit about me as well. And they can sign up for a newsletter. Now, I don't do newsletters very often, but what I always do is make sure that my newsletter recipients always see my covers first, and they'll always get the first few chapters of the book first before it's published. So they are always sort of ahead of the game. And if there are any deals out there, I'll let them know that. I am on Facebook, I am on X or Twitter, and I am on Instagram, and people can stalk me quite happily. I try to do a little bit of a balance between writing stuff and personal stuff. The personal stuff tends to come up more when I'm not in the throes of promoting a book, because we all know we then have to tip the balance there towards speaking about the book. But I do try to get personal, particularly in the newsletters. There'll be little aspects of my personal life in there. And if people follow me on Facebook, they can follow me as I travel the world, because I tend to spend 3 or 4 months a year on a ship. So they can follow me around the world as I go on my sailings.
Nice. There you go. Take Mike with you on the next trip. He's desperate.
Yay. Yeah,
the suitcase is full of friends already, I'm afraid.
Yeah. That's right. Well, listen, so what is your website so we can give it out?
It's kathyace.com.
Wow. How
my name, C-A-T-H-Y-A-C-E. And yes, in case anybody's interested, Ace really is my birth name. It's not an assumed pen name. That is my birth name. And in Swansea, there are a lot of Aces, believe it or not. If you look in the phone book, should they still exist? Umpteen Aces all over the place. We get about.
Well, that's good. We'll have that up on our website too, so people can get it, you know, and find you and send you all those letters.
Oh, thanks. I really hope they do. I love hearing from readers. And I do work hard to put myself out there and speak well about my work, but it's also nice to connect with people on that human level, you know?
Yeah, because not everybody can get out and see you, you know?
Exactly.
Well, we appreciate you being here and talking about writing and your latest book, of course, The Case of the Bereaved Butler. It's a cozy Welsh murder mystery full of twists, and it's part of the Wise Inquiries Agency Mysteries, and it's book 9. So, Kathy Ace, thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks ever so much for having me along. It's been lovely to chat.
Oh, I loved it. It was great.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.